What I want to try to do is really, I think today may be a little too ambitious, but I want to try to understand the end game of what's happening. I mean, we're up to Parshat Bo. At some point in Parshat Bo, we do get to the end. One of the things that, of course, needs to bother us from the very beginning is, and I've raised this question before, why doesn't God just say, okay, I'm taking you out, go? I mean, and I pointed out previously that a Sefer Bereishit thing would have been that God would have put the idea in his head and said, let him go. And we're always so much more troubled, and this is what we covered last week, we're so much more troubled in this, section where God micromanages apparently Paro's free will. And as I said, that's what we discussed last time. But the larger question is, why doesn't he just set them free? But there is a very deliberate process. Probably the most interesting analysis of the process is something that we should be familiar with from the Pesach Haggadah, when we're told that Rabbi Yehuda gave it simanim. The simanim of Rabbi Yehuda actually creates a system of 3 by 3, and what I mean by that is that the first nine are divided into 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, which the ones, which means 1, 4, and 7 are similar, and 2, 5, and 8 are similar, and 3, 6, and 9 are similar in terms of all kinds of issues, and a lot of commentaries get into that, and that helps explain post facto what's going on. Of course, what it ignores is number 10. Not ignores it, but it doesn't fit as easily into it. And number 10 is actually the most important plague because that's the one that will set them free. But as a starting point, I want to ask something else, which is actually a response to an artificial question. What I mean by an artificial question is that there's another way we can divide the plagues, and that is the first seven and then the second three. Why would I do it that way? And by the way, those numbers, 7 and 3, are actually really significant in terms of Kabbalistic doctrine, where there are 10 sefirot and you have the top three and then the lower seven, and this would be an inverse of this. But when I say that I can also divide it between 7 and 3, does anybody know why I would do that or how I can do that, where the 7 and 3 division comes from? And if you don't know off the top of your heads, it's actually one of these things that a lot of us were taught when we were very young. If you look at Parshat Va'era, and by the way, to remember this, the first two letters, Va'era, Vav and Aleph, 6 and 1 in their numerical value, that's 7. There were 7 in Va'era, and if Va'era, sorry, and if you look at this week's Parsha Bo, which is Bet and Aleph, which is 2 and 1, that equals to 3, and then there are 3 in this week's Parsha, which means, and the reason why I call it artificial is because the division of the parshiot is not the way the Torah was given. The division of the parshiot is based upon a custom of how we used to read the Torah, and I guess some of it we still do, but it's how the Torah was read in Bavel. There was actually an argument about how you divide the Torah up and how often you would finish it. In the land of Israel, the custom in antiquity was to read the Torah and to finish it every 3.5 years. So twice in 7 years they would finish the Torah, and then obviously the parshiot were much, much smaller, and the divisions were very different. So that's what I'm saying, is that there were two different customs on how you read the Torah, so the divisions of the parshiot is artificial based upon the custom in Bavel. So now, nonetheless, where and when they decided to make this division, they did do a division between the first 7 plagues and the last 3 plagues. And there is something about the last 3 plagues that there's a commonality about them. There's something which they all have in common, which in my mind is not incidental, and I think it's part of what they noticed. It's part of what Chazal saw. Again, the Chachmei Bavel, the rabbis of Bavel, when they made this decision or this division, I think this is what they had in mind. But of course, again, I can't be 100% sure, but let me show you what I noted. And I don't know if I've ever seen anybody note it before. I don't know. I can't tell you off the top of my head. But I think as you see it, it'll become something which is very obvious. And by the way, when we notice things, I'm getting ahead of myself. When we notice things, one thing we have to say, notice is the what, and then the next thing is the why, which means what it is and then why that may be or what the significance of it may be. So let's now take a look. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Bo El Paro, and people make lots and lots of interpretations. Why now does it say Bo El Paro? The truth is, it's not the first time that phrase is used. Bo el parol, ki nichvadati et libo vetavadav, leman shiti atotai eile bikirbo. And we're given a reason. The reason is because certain miracles have to take place. And then Pasuk Bet tells us something which is actually really important, probably more important for us than a lot of things that happened there. Uleman tisaper ba'aznei bincha uven bincha et asher hitalalti b'mitzrayim v'etototai asher samti bam v'yadatim kini Hashem. That we just now flipped into a future-oriented discussion, which means we completely ignored the present tense, because right now we're in the middle of a war. We're in the middle of a struggle for freedom, for redemption. And therefore, there's this present tense which is taking place in Egypt. And this, we'll see, by the way, along the way, hopefully, at least one of the commentaries that also notices a past tense perspective of something that has to happen over here. But right now, we're in a present tense, and God just switches directions on him. And this is actually, again, going to be a very important theme in this week's parsha, that in order for the future, for your children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, to know about what happened, to know about the miracles, to know about that I'm God, in order to know, to have knowledge of the of these experiences. So again, there is something just really interesting about this shift, because the whole time we thought Paro was, you know, the main character, and Paro now is really a side character who we need to talk about when we're going to be telling our children and grandchildren about what happened. So Pasuk Gimel then continues, and it goes back to the present tense, but just realize now that he just pushed him far into the future, and it's this shift into the future that I do want to really try to come back to as we go further on. But let's go back now to Egypt. Vayavo Moshe v'Aaron el Paro. They came to Aaron. Vayoma elav ko amar Hashem elokei Avraham ad matay ma'anta lanot mipanai shalachem mevivduni. Now, how long are you going to refuse? You know, send my people, let them free, let them serve me. For if you refuse to send my nation, my people, tomorrow I am going to bring arbe. Now, as far when we first hear this, so, you know, okay, so this is going to be arbe. What's arbe? Arbe is locusts. So our first impression of this, okay, you had frogs and you had, you know, lice, and now you have locusts. These are the plagues. But nonetheless, I'm going to insist that there's something about the locusts which is in common with the other plagues in this week's parasha, and not really to be compared to the ones that took place in last week's parasha, or the first seven. And look at the turn of phrase in Pasuk Hey, because this is going to begin to tell us what it is that I'm looking for. V'chisein v'chisa et ein ha'aretz. Now that's a really interesting turn of phrase. If you look at the English, and they shall cover the surface of the earth. But the word ein, which you know is so close to the word ayin, which is the word I, it's going to cover the ein haaretz. Now, just in case you think I'm imagining the I here, v'lo yuchal lirot et haaretz. It's going to cause an inability to see. So therefore, when you combine the inability to see, v'chisa et ein ha'aretz, you realize at very least it's dealing with a poetic choice of words over here, but it really means that this plague of arbe of locusts is going to cause something, which again, at first glance, we did not realize is an issue, and I hope you do by now, and that is darkness. V'lo yuchal lirot et ha'aretz. V'chal et yeter ha'pleita, and then we continue on in this plague, and something very interesting happens. Pasuk Zayin says, "Vayomru avdei paro." These are not the advisors. These are not the people on the payroll, the chief of staff, the army, secretary of state, but rather, "Vayomru avdei paro." His servants say, "Elav, ad matay yezel lanu lemokesh? For how long is this person going to be in a thorn in our sides? Shalach et anashim. Let them go. V'yavdu et Hashem Eloheim, and let them serve their God." Haterem teida, don't you know, ki avda Mitzrayim, that Egypt is lost? Now, in my mind, that is a spectacular verse. That means that it's crumbling. When I say it's crumbling, what I'm talking about is Paro's leadership is crumbling. Here is a man, and now I'm getting a little ahead of myself, here is a man who's not just the supreme leader. Anything that you imagine about leaders in various places at various times in history who are narcissists, who are self-absorbed, and so on and so forth. Paro has one up on all of them because within his culture, he's not just that. He's also a god. Paro is a god. And here you have servants talking to a god. And I'm saying, this is impossible. Or it can't be impossible because it's happening. But now the issue is what is happening. And that's what I want you to understand, that Egypt is unraveling. And that's part of what I want to notice as we go on today, both within the text and also within the midrashic expressions of what's taking place. But the fact that Paro's servants can turn to Paro and say to him, what is the matter with you already? Just let them go. What do we need this? But also I want you to note what it is that sets them off. Yes, there was before this, there was blood and there was frogs and there was pestilence and so on and so forth. But right now, something happens over here by this eighth plague. And what happens is, okay, just let them go already. You know, this is enough. Egypt is lost. So let's pay attention. So far what we have is something pushed the trigger. The other thing that we've noticed now is that, well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but all three plagues in this week's parsha, when I ask myself, what is common with these plagues? All three plagues have one common point, and that common point is they all have to do with a lack of the sun, or darkness, if you will. Why do I say that? One of the three is the easiest for me to say that, and that's going to be the next plague, the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. So, of course, the plague of darkness for 3 days, so therefore there's darkness. But now you realize there's not only darkness there's also darkness when it came to this locust plague, and there the Ein Ha'ar, it's the eye of the land, as it were covered up, and then nobody can see anything, so therefore you had darkness. The other plague, which is in darkness, which, again, may not have been our first thought, but now, in retrospect, it becomes very obvious, and that is the 10th plague, because the 10th plague takes place in the middle of the night, and that is the attack on the firstborn, or the death of the firstborn. So all three of these plagues take place in darkness. One of them is darkness because of locusts, one of them is darkness because there is this magical darkness, at least in the Egyptian place, and then the third one is in the middle of the night, where the firstborn die, and again, it is this time of darkness. And without understanding this issue of darkness, I don't want to overstate this, but without understanding this, I don't believe you can really understand what happens when liberation, or what the liberation is, or how this was understood by the Egyptians themselves, or by extension then, how this may have been understood by the Jews as well. Because I'll say it again, something over here just now happened, something took place, which is dramatic. And the first hint of it is the response of the Egyptian servants, who can have the audacity to turn to Paro and say, you know, just let them go already. You've lost. Now, how do you turn to your master and say you've lost? How do you turn to a king and say that you lost? And even more powerfully, how do you turn to a god and say to a person who is a self-styled god that you've lost? That's it. It's over. So those are the things that I want you to know. Those are the things I want you to think about as we're going to move forward. So they say this, and that's Pasuk Zayin, Tedaki Avdam Mitzrayim, Egypt is lost. V'yushavet Moshe v'et Aaron al Paro, and that has an impact. Then Moshe and Aaron are called back, v'yushav, they were brought back to Paro, v'yomer lehem, and he says, "Lechu, ivdu et Hashem lakechem." Go. Which means Paro finally gives in, which means the servants telling Paro it's over gets to him. Mi v'mi v'hochim. Who's going to go? V'yom Moshe says, "B'na'arenu, our children are going to go. U'v'zakeinenu nelech, and the elderly are going to go. B'vanenu, our sons, u'v'notenu, our daughters. B'tzonenu, u'v'kirenu nelech, kichag Hashem lanu." Which means everything is going to go. Our flocks and our animals, everything we're taking. Vayomer lehem, yichen Hashem imachem, kasher ashalach etchem ve'etapchem. Now, I'm not translating this. We'll look at the English, Ethan. And then he says, Ru'u ki ra'a neged pneichem. And he says, see, ra'a, and I just want to pause there for a second, neged pneichem is evil, if you want, I'll translate that as right now, is in front of you. Let's look at the way it's translated in English over here. He said to them, God be with you, if I would let you go with your little ones. See, evil is clearly before your faces. Now, sometimes, to understand the Torah, You need to know something which the Torah doesn't tell us about. Very specifically, what you need is you need to know something about mythology. So the question over here is, who is going to be the one who's going to teach us about Egyptian mythology? And the answer is going to be somebody who we did not necessarily expect to be our teacher, and that is going to be Rashi. Again, Rashi is would be our first turn anyway, generally, in order to look for explanations, understand things. But Rashi says something which he heard, and those of you who know a little bit about mythology are going to pick up on this Rashi. If you don't know it, don't worry. I'm going to explain it in a moment, and hopefully it will make a great deal of sense, and everything's going to change because of this. Rashi, in source number 2, here writes, Ra'u ki ra'a neged p'nechem. Evil is a front, evil. But it's really funny, because Paro just now said, fine, I'll let you go. Who's going to go? Everyone's going to go. And then Paro gives him this warning. And the warning is, again, Ra'a is right there. Ketaragumo. He goes, you want to know what it means? Look in the Targum, look at Onkelos. Uvimidrash Agadah Shamati, which is also interesting. He said, I've heard that. He didn't say he saw it inside, but he heard there's an explanation. Kolcha v'chad yesh shmo Ra'a. There is some kind of a star which is called Ra'a. Omer lem paro, or any it's daginut sheli. I've seen in terms of those who understand the stars, the constellations, shelotokochav olelu katchem b'midbar, that power, that star is going to meet you in the desert, vohu siman dam vahariga, and is going to be a symbol of death, of blood and destruction. And when the Jews sinned by the eagle, and God wanted to kill them out, Moshe said, why are you going to give them the opportunity to say that in Egypt they were right, that something about Ra is what met them along the way, or Ra took them out to kill them in the desert. And that's what it means over here, that evil is right there. And God then manipulated and turned that sign of blood into the circumcision. And we're going to leave that right now for the rest of the, without explaining this. Now, in the English over here, I went out of my way to translate this Ra as R-A, as Ra. And now I'll go back. Some of you who may know a little bit about Egyptian mythology will know that there was a god in Egypt, one of the many gods, which is called Ra. And over here, what's fascinating, and Ra, by the way, is the sun god. And the person who's the sun god is actually Paro. Paro believes that his power, and that's one of the things about Egypt. And by the way, there was no exclusivity in Egypt. It's that gods merged, gods changed, and so on. But if you look at the picture that I put up in the very beginning over here, this is a picture of Ra. If we're not all that sure about this, what we can do, let me see if I can quickly get this for you. Very simply, look at Wikipedia, which may not be our first place to necessarily look, but over here it is going to be very good. I'm going to share the screen again and go to Wikipedia over here. And over here it has the picture that I put up of Ra. Ra, ancient Egyptian, was translated, and so on. The deity of the sun. Sun as the creator, and so on. And you can read all this. Ra was this power that they had, or they believed in Egypt, and it was one of the roles which Paro himself believed to be the sun god. And now I want to go back and rethink everything what I've said so far today. What was my point where we started? That the first seven plagues are one, and that's why Chazal put them in Parshat Va'era. But the last three plagues all have something in common, and the thing that they have in common is the absence of the sun. Now, for us, the absence of the sun may not mean all that much, but if you were supposedly the sun god, and suddenly the sun is eclipsed, you have a problem. You have a problem in terms of your own self-confidence and belief, and you also have a problem in terms of explaining who you are in terms of others or the belief that others are going to have in you. And you see that something happened over here, that the Egyptian servants are able to say to Paro, it's over. Where does this come from? Well, I'll say again where it comes from. It comes from this darkness, the threat of darkness, and then the reality of darkness is that when we move from one to the other, again, going from first this idea of the locusts covering up the eyes, covering up all of light. The light is eclipsed, and now there's only darkness by locusts. It's not just the locusts. It's not just the destruction that they're doing, but already it's going to be a little bit foreshadowing for the next one, which is going to take place, and that is this total plague of darkness for 3 days. And if you're the sun god, or you believe in the sun god, or the sun god is this power in Egypt, and then there's no sun for 1, 2, 3 days, you have a very big problem. You have a problem, again, in terms of PR, and you have a problem in terms of yourself. You have a problem in terms of your confidence, and you need to know what you're doing. And by the way, on top of all of that, we know that when it came to the Jewish places, there was a sun. So that is absolutely horrific. Now, if you think about this again, and we move towards the final plague, and the final plague is the death of the firstborn, and the death of the firstborn is going to be an interaction between a couple of different elements. But one of them, I'm going to say it again, is this idea that this takes place in darkness. It takes place in the middle of the night. At midnight is when the plague strikes, and therefore you essentially have the sun god, as it were, not being able to help, not being able to, you know, facilitate in any way a healing. Is that the word we want to use? In order to, or protection. And suddenly Egypt is falling apart. So I'm going to try all this again, because I told you from the very beginning, part of what I want to try to understand today is the unraveling of Egypt. So therefore, when servants can say to a king, it's over, that's unraveling. When a sun god is eclipsed, that's unraveling. And the truth is, if we knew a little bit more about Egyptian mythology, we would have noticed this really much earlier within the entire story. So let's take a look and point out a couple of more things. And I hope you understood the argument that Rashi just now did, because it was phenomenal. The Jews sin with the golden calf. And Moshe argues and says, Lama yamu mitzrayim limor barotziyam larogotam. If you wipe out the Jews after the golden calf, Moshe is saying to God, this will be self-defeating, because the way it's going to play around the pagan world is not that you, the infinite God, took them out to save them, but rather Ra took them out in order to kill them. And now, if you read the words like Rashi just now said, he's saying, again, source 3, Lama yamu mitzrayim lemor, why are you giving the Egyptians the ability to say, Bera'ahotziam laharogotam barim? He's saying that this will be, it's a very strange thing to say to God. Moshe saying to God, if you kill the Jews, it's going to be a chilul Hashem, because people will think that you don't have enough power, and this other pagan god defeated you, and the pagan god is what took them out, not you, and the pagan god took them out in order to execute them, and therefore, if the goal of Judaism, and for that matter, world religion, is in order to get people all over to one day believe in the one God, Moshe is saying, yes, they messed up, and yes, they worshipped idols, and yes, they did something terrible, but if you wipe them out, this is going to play. The front page of the New York Times will not say that God punished them because they were evil. Instead, the New York Times will follow whatever mythology they believe in, and everything has to fit into their narrative, and their narrative will be that Ra killed them. So I'm saying that's a remarkable read. And Rashi just now told you that's how you should be reading that verse. When we look at source 14, and now this will be obvious, this is the idea of darkness. Again, Vayichaset ein kol aretz vatichshacha aretz, right? And as much as you may have thought that we're talking about the plague of darkness, we're not. This is still the plague of locusts. Vatichshacha aretz, and everything became dark, and the locusts went and they ate everything bare. Vayomer paro lekrol lemoshe l'aron vayomachatati l'Hashem. He goes, I've sinned. So what brought him to his knees, as it were, I'm going to say this again, it is this idea of darkness, but of course he changes his mind again, and pasuk yitet, kaf alef, uzov yom Hashem el Moshe, neteyadcha al Hashemayim v'yichol shecha l'aretz. Eretz Mitzrayim. So therefore, we went from darkness to darkness. And I said that's what we need to understand. Now, from the very beginning, we should have seen something else. This is a verse in Yechezkel, and it's actually read, many communities have this as the custom to read as one of the Haftorahs recently. Ben Adam Simpanech al Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Yechezkel is told to prophesy regarding Egypt. Vinavei alav al Mitzrayim kula. Daber v'amarta, prophesies regarding Paro and all of Egypt. Speak and say, Ko Amar Hashem Elokim, thus said God, Hineni alechu Paro Melech Mitzrayim. I'm on to you, Paro, king of Egypt. Hatanim hagadol, the great crocodile, haroveitz bitoch Ya'arav, who slithers about in his river, Asher Amar, and he's the one who says, Li Ya'ori, the river, the Nile is mine, Va'ani Asitini, and I made it, or I made it, the English here is, I made it for myself, which means part of Egyptian mythology is that Paro is god of the Nile. Now, nobody bother me and ask me, hold it, make up your mind, is he a god of the Nile, or is he a sun god? And the answer, as I said before, there's no exclusivity, that you could have multiple gods, multiple powers. They perceived the sun as being something which is powerful. They perceived the Nile as being something which is powerful. So therefore, what we have over here is a mix between these powers. But now what you have to understand is that the plague of blood, the Nile turns into blood. What does that do if you're the god of the Nile? I mean, they're just saying theologically, what does that do? Practically, what does that do? How in the world do you start to explain to people that you're the god of the Nile, but the Nile is bleeding? Moreover, how does the average person understand that the Nile, which they thought was a life force? That was the reason that when they refused to kill the children, they said, okay, you don't want to kill them, throw them into the Nile. The Nile will decide. And that's the reason why Moshe is claimed to be born of the Nile. She took him out of the Nile, and therefore she's claiming that he is a god. She's claiming that the Nile gave birth to Moshe. They believe the Nile was a life force, which means when we read these things today and we're so distant from the ancient mythology, we have a really hard time understanding it. And then you just have to now pay attention how many of the plagues, it's the Nile rebelling against Paro and the Nile rebelling against the Egyptians, which means frogs is not just frogs coming out of the river, it's frogs coming out of the river to abuse them. So therefore, I'm totally convinced, and I've actually had a couple of students over the years who've taken me up on this and did research and wrote about this and published about this, is that the more you understand about Egyptian mythology, the more you will understand what the plagues are and why they were seen to be so devastating. I'm going to say it again now. The most powerful god in Egypt was the sun god. And these last three plagues are bringing the sun god, you know, to his knees, as it were, because it's all over. But there's another thing about Egypt that we need to understand. And that's going to bring us again towards this final, towards the final plague. And the final plague is the one where, again, you look at Rabbi Yehuda Simanim, where, you know, I told you the first, fourth, then the seventh have something in common, and so on. The tenth one stands by its own. The reason is that the tenth one, God does not subcontract to either Moshe or Aaron to do anything. All the Jews are doing that night is they're doing their Passover service. But it's God himself who strikes the Egyptians, which, by the way, the verse there that says that I struck the Egyptians, we actually read that also into the Haggadah. In the Haggadah of Pesach, we say that it was God by himself, without a shaliach, without an emissary, without a messenger, without a malach, without anything else. It's God himself. Well, how do we say that if in the first nine plagues, God did have messengers, emissaries, people doing it? The answer is that only one plague took them out of Egypt, and that's the tenth one by itself. The first nine may have given them punishments. The first nine may have broken the resolve. The first nine may have weakened the theology of Egypt. But it was a tenth one that Paro then says, okay, go. That's it. It's over. And that's what we say in the Haggadah. Again, we sometimes don't necessarily understand it because as we're reading it, maybe we think it meant all ten. And then it's, what are you talking about? God does send Moshe and Aaron as his emissary. But the tenth is no emissary. And the tenth is no warning in that sense, at least. In the tenth comes, the firstborn is killed, but I'll take that back about the warning. It's more interesting than that. Let's take a look now and go back again to the sources. In retrospect, once the Jews leave, they break out and they sing a song. This is the Az Yashir. This is from next week. Source 6. Az Yashir Moshe Bnei Yisrael Tashir Azot Lashem Vayomu Lemor Ashir Lashem. Let's sing to God. Ki Ga'oga'a. Because there's a great deal of triumph gloriously or it's feeling proud, as it were. Sus V'Rachvo Rama Bayom. The horse and the rider fell into the sea. And then from verse 1 till 19, that's the whole Az Yashir, lots and lots of words, lots and lots of images and ideas. Verse 20, Vatikach Mirim HaNeviah, Achot Aharon, et HaTof Biyada. She takes, I think the best translation of the Tof is a tambourine. She takes it in her hand, Vatetsena Kol HaNashim Achareh B'Tupim U'Mcholot. They go out with their tambourines and they start dancing. Vatan LaMiriam, and Miriam then sang with them the refrain, Shir LaHashem Ki Go Ga'a, Sus V'Rechvo Rama Bayam. And she sings the same refrain, this idea of the horse and the rider falling into the sea. Source number 7, the Hamek Davar, he is the Nitziv. The Nitziv was the Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva of Volozhin. And he explains over here that the horse and the rider, which, by the way, all of us are familiar with, and what he's going to say, using a completely different image, which maybe we never thought about. So give me a second, and I'm going to explain what he says. He understands this as a political and economic vision, which was destroyed in the sea. And once we understand this, we'll be able to go back and understand what took place. Sus v'chorobay ramabayam. The horse and the rider sunk into the sea. Zu tamtzit hashira. That is this concentrated form of this song. K'muvan nishirat hanashim, as is noted, because that's the thing that the women sing. That's the refrain, as it were. Shelo omur elezeh hamikra. V'nyan demashmaut sus v'chon nichlal hakol. And when it comes to the matter of understanding the horse and the rider, you'll then understand everything. Just as the horse listens to the one who's riding on top of it, so too it's the case that the average soldier is going to listen to his master, and to go into fire or water. And the one who, let's say the captain, is like a horse, as it were, to the one who is the major. Vasara Elef, the Rosh Tzar Tzavot. And he is that way, he's like a horse when it comes to the chief of staff. And the chief of staff is at Paro Atzmot, to Paro himself. V'gam nechlal b'zeh ha'sar el-yona rechev l'marchot el-yona shel paro v'loto sar el-yona re'kol marcha nechshevet kesus, that everything needed something underneath it to support it. V'kol eila roma b'yam, and all of this sunk into the sea. V'zeo ga'a ala ge'im, that God took pride against those who had too much pride. Let me explain to you what he just now said. I'm going to give you another image of this, and then I hope it makes a lot more sense. What he's claiming is that Egyptian society was a society that everybody rode on something under it. In Egyptian society, I want to go back to the firstborn. In Egyptian society, the firstborn in every family had power over that family. They were the ones that everyone else needed to work for, needed to respect. What he's saying is that it was a society based upon a system whereby Paro was the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn, and therefore all those who are under him will work for him, but each one of those will have people under them. And that's ultimately why they needed a slave society to do all the heavy lifting for all the people on top. But let me stop and give you another image of all of this. And this will be like, say, oh, that's what's going on. The image is, of course, is a pyramid. Sitting on top of the pyramid is Paro. And then you have the top rung of the pyramid, which supports the very top. And then you have the rung underneath it, supporting those on top. And each level is supported by the ones underneath it. That is exactly what the Nitziv just now taught us in terms of understanding the horse and the rider, that every single echelon of society had a horse underneath it to do all of the difficult work. So what the Jews were watching sinking into the sea was not just the enemy. It was an economic system. It was a system which exploited the weaker elements of society. It was a society which needed the lower level horses in order to do all the heavy lifting so that everybody on top could have the work they didn't want to do by somebody underneath them. And the person who sat on the very top of this system was, of course, Paro. But I'm going to say it again now, in each and every family, you did have this idea of the firstborn. So therefore, when I'm going to, again, point out that Egyptian society is unraveling, things are falling apart. So part of what's going to fall apart now is going to be this attack on the firstborn. But now just realize the multiple things which are taking place at once. Part of it is something that we also know. When God, you know, does this really dramatic shift and starts giving laws. That's the beginning of chapter 12, Perek Yud Bet. He calls in Moshe and Aaron and says, okay, everybody take a sela bayit. You're going to take the lamb, and then you're going to put it away for a couple of days, and you're going to make matzah, and you're going to prepare maror, you're going to sit around, you're going to have a Pesach Seder, you're going to slaughter that animal, you're going to put the blood on the doorpost. By the way, I want you to realize this, that on a very, very simple level, that doorpost just now became a mizbeach, which means the Jews are now suddenly worshiping God in Egypt on Pesach night. We'll see in a couple of moments what Chazal do with this, but they're worshiping on Pesach night, and one of the things that the commentaries point out is the lamb was something which they worshipped. There were a whole bunch of indications of this along the way. At every single stage, when it became a discussion that Jews were shepherds, oh, that's distasteful for the Egyptians because they worshipped these animals, and the Jews just treated them as animals, and that was part of the problem that the Jews had in Egypt. So now, again, if you stop there for a moment and you think about what I just now said, to take an Egyptian god, the lamb, again, all this is symbolic, and to slaughter it and to put its blood on the doorpost, that was unbelievably liberating because the Jews just now killed one of the gods of Egypt. When you have this following up after the darkness and then the darkness and now the darkness coming one after the other, those three plagues that have to do with the dark, so therefore there is this other element which is being weakened. When you take on top of this idea of the firstborn, which is now going about to be struck, the firstborn again has this incredible power within each and every family. And again, keep in mind that Paro is the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn sitting on top of the pyramid. What we're about to see now is that the pyramid is going to come crashing to the ground, and Egyptian mythology, Egyptian theology, Egyptian idolatry, is all of it is all about to disappear. And that's what's being played out in front, again, as we get to this final plague. So let's go back now and look again. Source number 10, which is in Perek Yud Bet. V'yi b'chatzi ha'layla. You know, right there in the middle of the night, it's dark. V'ashem hika kol b'chor b'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, part of what we need to note here before anything else is really to go back a little bit and to read something which, in source 15, where it gives the instructions what to do that night, u'lakachtem agudat ezov, u'tavaltem bedam, asher b'safi, gatem amashko. If you're going to take this thing, you dip it in, you're going to put the blood on the doorposts. V'elshtem u'zot min adam asher b'saf. And again, I'm going to stress that the putting blood is later what's going to happen on the altar itself, on the mizbeach. V'atem lo titzu ish mipetach beto ad boker. God gives an order. You cannot leave the house until the morning. So therefore, they're told to stay at home. So now, at midnight is when the Egyptians are going to be struck. And there's one more thing, and that is also, it's right not here in front of us right now, maybe I'd have to look for it to see if I put it here someplace, is someplace along the way, Paro says, that's it, I never want to see you again. And maybe you remember that from the movie, that you're not going to see my face again. And Moshe says, as you wish. Okay, that's it. You don't want to see me again? Then I won't see you again. Let me just see if I have that here someplace. So there's two elements which are interesting. One, Paro says, you're not going to see me again. And two, God gave an instruction that you are not leaving the house all night. Rather, and this is important for us, why is this called Passover? Why is it called Pesach? It's called Pesach because God passed over the Jewish homes. The Jewish homes that had this Passover service taking place were saved, and all the other homes were struck that night. V'hi b'chatzi ha'layla, source 10. V'ashem ikakol b'chor b'hem Mitzrayim, v'b'chor paro ha'yoshev al kiso ad b'chor ha'shvi asher b'beit ha'bor v'chol b'chor b'hema. Every firstborn of every single element of society was killed. V'yakam paro laila hahu. And Paro gets up at night. V'kol avadav, v'kol mitzrayim. V'yitzaka gedula b'mitzrayim. So in the middle of the night, and remember, sun god in the middle of the night, all the firstborn, which had this power, ki ein baita she'ein shamet. In every home, they've suffered now because every home has lost its firstborn. V'yikran l'moshe l'aron laila. And he calls to them in the middle of the night. V'yomer, kumu tzu'u mitoch ami. Get up and leave. Gam atem, gam b'nei Yisrael, uluchuv du'ot Hashem ki devarchem. Go serve God. Gam tzonchem, gam b'korchem, kichu kashe dibartem, v'lechu uvirachtem gam oti. Which means now everything has taken place. And now Paro has said, go, take everything and go and bless me as well. So now you realize that the self-styled God, the sun God, the God of the Nile, he's been taken to his knees. Everything has unraveled. Everything has fallen apart. And he says, go. In Pasuk Lamed Hey, it says, V'nei Yisrael suka dvar Moshe. They did what Moshe had instructed. V'yishalu Mitzrayim klei kesef klei zahav u'smalot. And they went and they borrowed, as it were, the various gold and silver and so on. And at some point then, we're going to be told in the next couple of verses that the Jews will, in fact, leave. Part of what concerns me is when exactly they leave. And to figure out or to understand, what's going on, and as I said, the unraveling, let me point out a couple of things. One is in source number 11, is a verse that we should recognize. It's said every Shabbat in the Psuke de Zimra, Lemakeh Mitzrayim Bivchoreihem Kilam Chasdo. One of the many, many things that God did is he struck the Egyptians in their firstborn. But the Midrash Tanchuma, which you have in the English as well here, paints a different picture. And this goes back to my point of the unraveling. And again, I'm going to stress that this is a Midrash, but it's a Midrash which encapsulates what Egypt is probably experiencing at this point in terms of this unraveling of authority. Nitkansu kol b'charot etzel avihim. All the firstborn went and approached their fathers. Amru lehem. Kol masha mamosha hevi aleinu. Moshe's been 9 for 9 so far. Everything that's been said, and again, I'm exaggerating a little bit because not every single plague had warnings to it, but they essentially say he's been 9 for 9. Everything that he says has happened. Ein atem mevakshim shenichyeh. You don't want that we're going to live. Elabo v'netziah. And now there's two traditions, ha'avadim, either the slaves, or ha'ivrim, the Jews, halelumi b'neinu, let them go already. I mean, we're going to die, because Paro is going to be so stubborn, we are going to die. V'im lav, hari anu meitim. If you don't let them go, we're going to be dead. Hishivotam v'amr lehem afilu kolam mitzrimetim en yotzim mikan. And he said, no, even if everybody dies, we're not letting them go. And again, this is their parents speaking. Ma'asu, what did the firstborn do? Nitkansu kol b'charot, v'chu lehem etzel paro, v'yimitzavchim al paro. They all went and gathered, and they had a protest in front of Paro, and they started screaming, let them go, because of this, the evil's going to come. And by the way, with the word ra again, you have to pay attention to that. Instead, this is going to boomerang, and we are all going to suffer, we're all going to die. Goes, go and tie them up, get rid of them. What do they do? Each one took a sword and killed his own father because his own father was not rebelling. Now, I'm not telling you this is pshat. I'm not telling you this is what's happened. But I'm telling you that this does capture the feelings. And he says, Shenemar limakat mitzrayim bivchoreihem, how Egypt was struck by the firstborn. So he's saying it doesn't mean, as this pshat, that the firstborn died, they will die, but rather they were struck by the firstborn because the firstborn rebelled, which means essentially you have this pyramid now falling apart, because if the firstborn can go and yell at Paro and tell Paro, what are you doing? And people are yelling at their parents and so on. You have over here a complete devaluation of morals. And you have, again, this disintegration of Egyptian society. So that was one midrash, which I found really interesting. Second idea is in terms of exactly when it was that they left. We just now read a verse that said that Paro goes calling to Moshe and Aaron and says, you can leave, take everything. So look at Rashi in source 14. Vayikra l'Moshe l'Aaron laila. He goes out looking for them at night. Now, there's going to be a problem. The problem is God already said you can't leave, don't, no one leave their house till the morning. Magid she'yemachzer al pitchei ha'ir v'tzo'ek. He went around screaming, Heichan Moshe, where's Moshe? Heichan Aaron, where's Aaron? Which means, again, there's two things to keep in mind. One, he says, you're never going to see me again. And they said, okay, fine. And secondly, God said, you can't leave until the morning. And Paro's running around looking for them. All the Israeli kids learn this great song, Paro b'pijama b'emtza laila. Paro's running around in his pajamas in the middle of the night looking for Moshe and Aaron. But nonetheless, as we saw in Source 15, God says not to go. Now, there is a little bit of, I'll call it tension in the sources, because, for example, in Bamidbar, when it counts all the travels in Parshat Maaseh, it says, Mimachrata Pesach Yatzu Bnei Israel Biyad Ramale Nekom Mitzrayim. It says that this day after the Pesach, they went Biyad Ramale Enei Kol Mitzrayim. By the way, that indicates that this would have been during daylight. On the other hand, in Source 17 in Dvarim, we have a retrospective. It says, Shemor et chodesh ha'aviv, vasita pesach la'shem lecha, ki b'chodesh ha'aviv, hotziach shem lekecha mitzrayim laila, that God redeemed them at night, took them out at night. So which is it? Is it night or is it day? And the Pasuk Vav, right after that, says, ki im el makom ha'shivcha shem lekecha mitzrayim laila, tizbach et pesach ba'arev, that you should bring the Passover offering in the evening, kivo ha'shemesh, when the sun sets, mo'ed the time that you left Egypt. Now that's really interesting, because now you have three different candidates for when they left. Did they leave in the morning? Did they leave at night, you know, after midnight? And over here it says no, that the evening is when they leave Egypt. What does it mean the evening? Mo'ed Tzeitcha Mitzrayim, the time Kivo HaShemesh is when the sun sets, unless I'm misreading this. But I'm just saying these are the things that need to be paid attention to. This Sifri is going to reconcile it. Did they really go at night? They left during the day. They were redeemed at night. So now the question really is, what does it mean that they were redeemed at night? And here again, I want to pause a little bit, because the truth is that there are various aspects of redemption. There are various stages of redemption and aspects of redemption. And redemption is not something, again, let me put it like this. It's something which could have an economic side to it. It can have a political side to it. It could have an emotional side to it, an experiential side to it. There's many, many feelings and aspects of it. And by the way, one of the reasons this is so important is in terms of our own lives. How do we experience something which is redemption? How do we feel free? Or the opposite takes place as well. How do we sometimes feel overwhelmed? And what do we need in order to be able to feel free? So what the Sifri just now articulated, and this is also very clear from the Talmud Bavli, that there were different stages of the redemption, that they were redeemed. The word ge'ula, redemption, took place at night, even though the actual geographic redemption doesn't take place till the morning. But first I want to go back for a moment and speak about the experiential side of it, because I think the experience sometimes is really quite important. And I want to read, and I love this source. I'm just telling you, I love this source. It's completely fantastic. When I say fantastic, I mean in terms of fantasy. It is total fantasy. It's not what happened. And I don't want any of you to think that I think it's what happened. But I love it nonetheless, because what this teaching does, and I'm going to call it a midrash, even though it's in a Targum. I'm going to call it a midrash. What the midrash does is it speaks of experiential truth. You know, and we live in a world which sometimes is so focused on truth only in terms of historical truth. But there's not just historical truth. There's also an emotional truth. And if what I'm saying right now is terribly confusing, let me first read the teaching, try to explain it, and then hopefully you'll understand what I'm saying. Later on, when they get to Har Sinai, in Source 19, Atem re'item, asher asiti le'mitzrayim, You saw what I did in Egypt when I put you on the wings of eagles and I brought you to me. Now, pshat in that pasuk is that the Jews were taken out of Egypt and brought to Mount Sinai. That's the pshat. That's what the verse says. But the Targum, this is the Targum Yonatan, a Targum Yerushalmi, it's the pseudo Yonatan, has this phenomenal imagination. We'll read the Hebrew. This is the Keter Yonatan, is the Hebrew translation. Atem re'itim ma'asher asitim l'mitzrayim. You saw what I did in Egypt. V'nasati etchem al ananim, and I took you on clouds, kimo al kanfei nisharim, which is like the wings of eagles, min Ramses, I took you from a place called Ramses, which we're familiar with, v'ovalti etchem l'makom beit ha-mikdash, and I took you to the place that the Beit HaMikdash will one day stand, lasot sham Pesach, in order to bring the Korban Pesach. Uvahu laila, but then later on that night, hashafti etchem l'Ramses, I brought you back to Ramses, umisham kirafti etchem l'lmod torati, and then I taught you my doctrine, my Torah, my law that night. What in the world is this midrash or teaching, Targum, trying to say to us? Where did the Jews have the Korban Pesach that night? The answer is in Egypt. Where did Jews do the Korban Pesach throughout history? In Jerusalem. But we weren't in Jerusalem. We couldn't be in Jerusalem. There was no Jerusalem. There was no Beit HaMikdash. There was no Mizbeach. So what is this fantasy that the Midrash is teaching us? What it's doing is expressing emotional truth, experiential truth, which means how did the average slave feel in Egypt that night, putting on their coats, taking their walking stick in hand, being told that they're leaving that night, eating matzah, because in the morning they're going to leave so quickly that the matzah is not going to have time to rise. I'm going to say that again. They were commanded to eat matzah that night in Egypt before they left, because in the morning they're going to leave so quickly that they're not going to have time for the matzah to rise, which means at that moment they're already experiencing the future. They're already experiencing the leaving. They're already experiencing being free. Taking the Egyptian god and slaughtering the Egyptian god is something which is liberating, which means what experientially, and again, don't talk about reality now, experientially, where did the Jews keep Pesach that first year? And the answer is the Jews celebrated Pesach that first year in the built Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, even though I know and you know it didn't, and they know it didn't exist yet, that didn't mean that they didn't feel it. They felt it, they experienced it. That was what Pesach was. And by the way, that actually tells us what Pesach was always supposed to be. Pesach is always supposed to be a day that we feel freedom. It's always supposed to be a day that we can understand the future, or for that matter, sometimes understand the past. In every generation, people should see themselves as if they left Egypt. What does it mean to leave Egypt? It means to be able to feel the future and to feel the day that you're completely free. So the Jews, and we should see ourselves as if we left Egypt. And what does it mean to leave Egypt? To leave Egypt means that you're able to believe in the future, in a future where you're absolutely free and able to walk free, as it were. So the Jews that night celebrated in Jerusalem. And that's this incredible teaching. And again, I could ask this again. Is it true that they experienced Passover in Jerusalem? And I can say, yes, it's true, because I just threw in one extra word in that. And that extra word was experienced. That was what their experience was. That's what they felt. You want to deny somebody's feelings? You want to deny what somebody experienced? I'm not talking now about geographical truth, and I'm not talking about historical truth. What I'm talking about is emotional truth, because that's part of what being free is. Part of the sense of freedom is to feel, by the way, that's probably the most important part of freedom. But the most important part of freedom is feeling and believing in the future. You believe the future is going to be different. I mean, I've said this many times, and don't get upset with me. And I'm not talking about all cases. I'm not talking about all people. And I'm absolutely not trying to belittle some very serious issues. But sometimes people feel depressed. I'm not talking about clinical depression. Sometimes people feel depressed because something bad happened yesterday, and their today gets ruined because they're overwhelmed by yesterday. And mostly this happens because they can't believe in tomorrow because they're stuck in yesterday. The person who's able to go to sleep at night and say, yes, it was a bad day, but tomorrow's going to be a better day. The person who feels that liberation of the next day is able to take that depression and have it lift off over them because of the belief in tomorrow. those of us who are able to believe in tomorrow, and maybe we should talk much more about this in another time, but those of us who could believe in tomorrow don't get trapped by yesterday. And that's part of the experience of slavery. Slavery is a monotony of yesterdays, because every day is the same and there's no reason to believe tomorrow will be every better. Day after day after day after day after day is the exact same thing in terms of slavery. But once that slave is able to put on their coats and take their walking stick in hand and able to be told, no, we're leaving, this is it, it's over. And any of them who believed it and then took, again, one of the gods of Egypt, they took the lamb and they slaughtered the lamb and they put the blood on the doorpost, experientially, they are already in the land of Israel. Experientially, they're already free. And that means when we saw this contradiction, when were the Jews liberated? Wow, that's really interesting. When were the Jews really liberated? Were they really liberated at night? Were they really liberated? And I'll give you three possibilities. Are they liberated at the moment that they slaughter the Passover offering, which is the evening? Are they liberated when they sit down and they eat it? Are they liberated at midnight when the firstborn is struck, which is, again, another thing that the Egyptians believed in? Or are they liberated when they actually walk out of Egypt in the morning? And the answer to that question is yes. Yes, each one of those are stages of liberation. Each one of those are stages of freedom. And each one of those are experiences of freedom that takes place. There's another beautiful midrash that I want to use again, not necessarily because it's literal in terms of how it took place, but again, it encapsulates what it means to actually be free. So what were we up to? We were up to Paro running around, looking for Moshe, looking for Aaron. And again, we have a problem. The problem is that God said that no one's to leave their house until the morning, and Paro runs around in the middle of the night looking for Moshe and Aaron, and presumably telling them that it's time to go. Over here in Source 21, the Gemara is going to say, Amar Rebbe Abba, Hakol Modim, everyone agrees, Kishin Nagalu Yitzro Mitzrayim, Ge'ula, redemption, Lo Negalu Eleba Arev. They were be'erev. When were they redeemed? They were redeemed at night. Ukishiyatsu leyatsu elibayom. But when did they leave? They left in the day, which means they're liberated before they leave. Barb Marley, actually, he borrowed this. He ripped this off. Yeah, if you want, I can tell you who he stole it from. That you should emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. That part of what slavery is that it's in your mind that you feel slaved. Right? No one else can free our minds. Right? And by the way, and what's the name of that song? Hopefully you know it. Redemption Song. I mean, by the way, it is so perfect because it encapsulates, again, this exact idea. The Jews were redeemed at night because at that point they believed in the morning. In the morning they actually left, but they were redeemed before that. Why? Because they were able to liberate themselves from mental slavery. So again, if you want to know who he really stole that line from, I can reveal that, but not this moment. Continuing, the same thing is taught in the Gemara, also in source number 22, which is Gemara in Daf Dalet. But I want to read a particular midrash. First, we'll start with a very ancient midrash, source 23, which is the Mechilta of Yikra Lemosh La'aron Magid Shahaya Paro Machzer V'Shua B'Kol Eretz Mitzrayim. He's looking all over. Heichan Moshe. Right. This is what Rashi quoted. Where's Moshe? Where's Aaron? Vayomer kum tzu mitochami. They said, go, get out. Amalo Moshe, musharimanu. But God told us, shilaletzet, elibifarhesya. It's interesting not to go yet, but no, we have to do this when it's clear, when it's in public. Shinamam vatem lotetzu ishmi petach beto adboker. You can't leave till the morning. Okay, I'm going to come back and explain this again. Look over here, we are in source 24. We're going to go skip to the second paragraph. Vayikam parom. Laila, Paro got up in the night. Talmud Lomar, who ya machziro pitchem shel avadav, umamidan kolachad. He woke everybody up, all of his servants. Valechimam vaomer, heichan Moshe, vaaron shurim. Where are they? Shenemar v'yikra l'Moshe l'Aaron Laila, that he went calling for them. V'yikra, calling. V'yomer kumatzu, go, leave. Amud lo Moshe, but Moshe responds and said, kach tzivano kadosh baruch hu, v'atem lo teitzu ish mipetach beito ad boker. God said we can't leave till the morning. Are we like, you know, criminals that we have to go sneak out in the middle of the night? We're only going to leave in the morning where everybody can see us. And I want you to focus on, because we're going to get back to where we started. V'lama bahu v'avadav, why does Paro and his servants come? Lo melacha, shebishar sha'amalo Paro al tosif ro'ot panai, when Paro said, you're not going to see me again, amalo Moshe, kein dibarta, lo osif od ro'ot panecha, right? We're not going to see you again. Paro says, go. And Moshe says, no. So you have to realize or appreciate how almost comical that is. What was the moment of freedom? I mean, when does it really take place? You know, sometime after midnight, all the firstborn die. And again, let's just go back to what we've seen so far today. And as I said, I want to wrap it all up and try to make sense of it all. One is we've seen that this parsha, Parshat Bo, all three plagues have to do with the night. They all have to do with darkness. Going from the time that the Ein Ha'aretz is covered up with the locusts, going on to darkness, the plague of darkness going on to the firstborn in the middle of the night, light, the sun god, Paro, is eclipsed. That was number one. What else did we see unraveling, falling apart? That the servants say to Paro, it's over. Okay, I think that goes together. There were elements of this from the very beginning, from when the Nile, god of the Nile, when the Nile turns into blood, when the frogs, and again, so on and so forth. What we see over here are rebellions and a cracking of this whole Egyptian mythology. Finally, we move over to this point where the sun god suddenly has no power whatsoever, and there's darkness all over Egypt. And for them, you know, look, darkness is a time that we get afraid. Darkness is a time of fear. But darkness for an Egyptian, when your god is the sun god, and the Nile is blood, and the sun god now is all darkness, that's so much more powerful. And when the firstborn, which were on top higher, you know, places on this pyramid, when they all start falling apart, when they all start disappearing, so again, things at this point become a lot more frightening for the average Egyptian. Finally, Paro tracks down Moshe, and he says to Moshe, go. It is time to go. You're free. Whatever it is that you wanted to do, the God you wanted to serve, go and serve. You're free. And there is nothing more for you to do over here. I'm not stopping you. Go. And at that moment, Moshe does something, which again, I hope you appreciate, is really interesting in terms of freedom. What does Moshe do? According to this beautiful midrash, he says, no, we're not criminals. We're not, and Paro, again, one of these sources, I didn't read them all, Paro then says, no, I command you to go. And Moshe says, no, we're not going. Which means, what was the moment of freedom? So I want to go back again. There's a moment of freedom when the Jews experientially slaughter this god of Egypt and they put the blood on the doorposts, when they sit down and they celebrate Passover Seder, which again, one source told us experientially they're already in Jerusalem. When the firstborn is struck down, there's something again about that which is liberating. And that's actually, according to the Netziv, what they celebrate when they go through the sea. The horse and the rider has fallen apart. The society that always needed something underneath to do the heavy lifting, that society has completely fallen apart, which is, again, not just the mythology. It's also this economically abusive society that needed these people who were weaker in order to do all of the difficult work, and they were taken advantage of along the way. The other element over here is finally at midnight when Paro says, you're free, go. And Moshe says, wonderful. And now I'll restate that midrash. My first act of freedom then is I hereby declare that we're not leaving even though we're free. But Paro says, go, you're free. He says, correct. And that's why we're not leaving, which means Moshe exercising his freedom is saying, I'm not going until the morning because I'm free. I can go when I want to go. Paro says, go now, because, you know, look at all these plagues that you bring on us. And Moshe looks and says, no, we're not going now. Why? Because God commanded not to leave to the morning. Now I want to go back and think about the significance of the morning. What happens in the morning? In the morning, the sun rises. Which means, just in case, that all along the way, people were thinking, okay, maybe the sun god had a bad day. Maybe he had a couple bad days. Maybe, you know, he was working on whatever, recharging his sun battery pack, or whatever the case may be. Which means it was incredibly important for the Jews to leave as free people, specifically to leave Egypt and to leave the sun god in the morning when the sun comes up and there's no more excuses, there's nothing else that you can say, and then they walk out and say goodbye. Had they snuck out in the middle of the night, it's not just that it's not dignified. It would have been interpreted, oh, they left at night when the sun god wasn't watching or when the sun wasn't up, but they could not have done that during the day. Okay. we'll do this during the day now. It has to happen during the day, which means the flip side of these three plagues in this parsha having to be at night or having to be with darkness, the flip side is that the actual leaving of Egypt is during the day, and that itself was incredibly meaningful, both to the Egyptians and to the Jews. And part of what I'm pointing out now is that there are many stages to redemption, many, many stages to redemption. And sometimes we need to be able to have a really, you know, sharp eyesight to see it, and sometimes it's blatant and manifest in front of us, but there are stages to redemption. There are stages to redemption which are economic, there are stages to redemption which are geographical, and there are stages to redemption which are emotional. And the Jews experienced all of those things. Part of our celebrating Pesach and part of our living in the world today is understanding that there are stages. Those of us who are stuck in the present are going to be depressed. Those of us who think that tomorrow can't get any better because yesterday wasn't good are ones who don't understand the secret of redemption. The secret of redemption is to be able to do what that Targum said they did, is they were able to celebrate in Jerusalem that night. And I believe it's absolutely 100% true. And again, I'll qualify it. It's true emotionally. It's true experientially. That's where they were. They were in Jerusalem. Because a Jew celebrating Passover, celebrating liberation, celebrating freedom, is sitting in Jerusalem with the temple built, total economic and political and geographical liberation and freedom. That's what it means to really celebrate Pesach. That's what the Jews did. Meaning, if that's celebrating Pesach for us, then we shouldn't expect any less for the Jews who actually experienced the redemption. Yes, they left in the morning, but there was a moment of freedom at night, but there was a moment of freedom even at sunset, and there were these moments of freedom all along the way. It's very important for us today to also appreciate moments of freedom in our own life, belief in a future, belief in understanding things are going to be better and things are going to move in a direction which are going to be absolutely amazing. And I say this as not in terms of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I say this in terms of the last 75 years and where we are today and where we're moving forward to, that we are very fortunate where we are. But we need to believe in tomorrow, because tomorrow there are still these unbelievable stages that still have to take place. But yet, on the other hand, we all know, our grandparents or great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents would have known, that even to be locked up in your room in Israel and have, and by the way, think of where you are. You're 5 minutes from Somit Misubim. Somit Misubim is where Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues had a Pesach Seder all those years ago. Right, it says that they were in Misubim. That's where they were. That is the actual place of where the ancient Bnei Brak was, and that's why it's called Somit Misubim. They were leaning back that night. Again, a couple of minutes, literally a couple of minutes of where you're right now. So yes, you're locked in your rooms, as it were. You're locked on the campus, as it were, right now, in a place that Rabbi Akiva had his Seder with his colleagues, with his, and his students knocked on the door, and they said, "Rabbi, the sun has come up, and it's time to serve God." So very soon. Our students will knock on the door and say, "The sun has come up, we can go outside, and everything is free." That's part of what it's about. That's part of what liberation is about. And even if you're in the middle of the night and you're locked in the house and realize that the morning is going to come and the sun is going to come up, and it's going to be time to say Kriyat Shema Shel Shacharit. And that's what the Jews experienced that night. And that's why the Kriyat Shema Shel Shacharit of Rabbi Akiva's students is so important, because that's when they actually leave, when the sun comes up. And now, hopefully, we have much better insight or understanding why the sun is such an important element of all of this.